Welcome to Dose Nation. I am James Kent. You're listening to The Untouchables, Free Yourself, from the EP Dance Party from 1986. One of my favorite albums of all time, The Untouchables. All right, there's a sentiment that should be familiar to anybody in the psychedelic community, the concept of freeing yourself or freeing your mind. It's one of the concepts that I'll be exploring over the course of these 10 episodes, the last 10 episodes of Dose Nation. If you're just tuning in, these are the last 10 episodes of Dose Nation, and I'm doing something a little different with these last 10. Because it is the end of Dose Nation, and with the end of Dose Nation, it's also kind of the end of my career in psychedelic publishing, which started about 25 years ago. So at the end of this run, I found it's the appropriate time to talk about some of the lingering thoughts that I have about psychedelic culture and psychedelic philosophy. I think it's better to talk about these issues at the end of a long project than at the beginning because, frankly, some of them may be unpopular. They're ideas that are somewhat conflicted in my mind. They rattle around in my head, and I dwell on them a lot, maybe more than I should. And this process of recording these last 10 episodes is a way for me to purge myself of these ideas that have been in my head that I haven't really expressed anywhere. I haven't even really verbalized them at all. So this is a little bit of an experiment, and I may go off on tangents where it sounds like I'm railing against the entire community or putting myself at odds with psychedelic culture. And you know, that's not really my point of view. My view on psychedelics hasn't really changed since the beginning. I still believe they are powerful tools, perhaps the most powerful tools, for exploring the human psyche and the potential of the mind and the limits of the human imagination. I think if anything has changed over the years, it's my view on psychedelic philosophy and how that philosophy trickles through the community. And beyond that, how beliefs are fashioned and how belief systems are built to sustain a community or to hold a community together. And this was always a big area of interest for me, even back before I started taking psychedelics. I was very interested in the way that belief is programmed into people by their culture. We all have beliefs that we walk around with, and by and large, they're not our own beliefs. I mean, we like to think that all of our thoughts are individual and that they're unique. But more often the case is that our ideas have been fed to us or suggested to us from external sources. And then they mull around in our heads and they're integrated. And eventually they become part of our own thought processes. And we adopt beliefs and we adopt ideas based on the cultures that we're raised in. Now, personally, I am an atheist and a skeptic. And I'm an atheist with a small a, because I don't discount the possibility of there being a god or a godlike creature out there somewhere. I just have a very skeptical view of human religions and human philosophies because of their deficits and the areas where they don't make sense or they don't add up. Now, I wasn't always an atheist, and it may seem weird that my conversion to being an atheist came somewhere towards the end of my experimentation with psychedelics. Whereas you might think that the longer somebody explores psychedelics and adopts psychedelic philosophy, the more convinced that they will be that a spirit world exists. But for me, it was the opposite. I came into the community and the culture with some experience in psychedelics, fully expecting to investigate this notion of a shamanic spirit world. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, and how I was drawn to that idea and how I was drawn into that notion, primarily by Terence McKenna and others of that nature. But before I get to my personal story about how I got thrust into this community and this line of exploration, I wanted to step back and address one of the big ideas that lingers with me that I wanted to talk about in these episodes, and that is the notion of psychedelic legitimacy and whether or not the psychedelic experience is a legitimate use of the human brain. Now, for those of you who have experience with psychedelics and cherish a psychedelic experience, you know that there's a lot there. You know that there's a lot to explore, and there's positives and there's negatives. And the community, by and large, is full of cheerleaders who want to promote the psychedelic experience and promote all of the good things about the psychedelic experience. And it always struck me as odd, a little odd, that most of the books and most of the literature on psychedelics are really kind of glowing praises of the experience, you know, and they want to link it to mysticism and higher consciousness and the healing potential and all of these wondrous promises of the psychedelic experience. And very rarely, only very rarely, do you see someone highlight the negative aspects. Maybe there might be a chapter at the end of a book or a few paragraphs somewhere in the middle of a book saying, oh yeah, and by the way, these substances can be dangerous, so be careful. And, you know, follow some basic rules of safety when you use them, so, you know, you don't freak out. Unfortunately, people do freak out. I've had freak outs. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. But this subject of psychedelic legitimacy, I think, has really cast a weird pall over the entire community. And it all goes back to prohibition, of course. Because when the government, the federal government, Congress, made the decision to ban psychedelics, they gave a flat judgment that the psychedelic experience was not a legitimate experience. It was not compatible with modern society, and it was dangerous. So, the prohibitionists really set the stage for this legitimacy argument. My personal belief is that all drugs should be legalized, and they should be regulated to some extent so they can be sold with proper purity and in the proper dosage with the proper warnings and the proper labeling and all of that stuff that we expect from our products, our products in the modern world should come with all of that stuff and with all of those guarantees built in that you're getting a pure product and you're getting it at the right dose and you're getting it with some instructions. But Prohibition ruined that. And ever since that time, there has been a uphill battle in various aspects of the community attempting to re-legitimize the experience post-Prohibition. Now, before Prohibition, there were, you know, a few schools or a few threads of the community that were taking hold. There was the psychological experimentation community that was, you know, making a lot of progress and using psychedelics and therapy, psychotherapy, to work through issues and uncover problems in people's lives. And then there was, you know, of course, Leary's movement, which was more about exploring, you know, the mystical nature of psychedelics and empowering the self. And he had his own kind of propaganda that he and his Harvard crew, Metzner and Alpert, put together with their manual, The Psychedelic Experience, which borrowed from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, of course. And then there was this entire group of psychedelic pranksters who didn't really believe in anything more than undermining culture and subverting cultural ideas and, you know, pranking the idea of modern society. You know, the Ken Keseys, the Yippies, the Allen Ginsbergs. These are the people that I mostly associated myself with when I was first introduced to psychedelics. I was very into the cosmic joke and what does it all mean, and it's all meaningless, and everything that we do is sort of a facade, and, right, very nihilistic, very just centered in the now, this idea that all human behavior is a form of public theater and we're all just acting our roles. And that was all very, very alluring to me, this idea of the pranksterism and the cosmic joke and the nihilism. So that's where I came from. Those were the ideas that I was, you know, kind of attached to, that I associated the psychedelic experience with. I wasn't really thinking mystical. I wasn't really thinking spirit world. I was very much a part of the recreational user culture, sort of off to the side of party culture. You know, party culture has always been around. Before Prohibition, after Prohibition, party culture endures. And I respect party culture. I think party culture is an extremely legitimate part of society. And in many ways, I respect party culture more than deeper philosophical trends or threads in the community that try to turn the psychedelic experience into something more. There's no pretense in party culture other than wanting to have a good time and maybe enjoy the event or the show. And that's what, you know, my philosophy was. I was looking to, you know, find an event, find a concert, find a show, find a Grateful Dead show that I could go to and, you know, drop acid and dance my ass off and have a good time. And when I hallucinated, I was hallucinating the iconography of what I thought that philosophy was all about. You know, it was a lot of harlequins and jesters and the cosmic fool and magicians pulling the ace of spades or the joker out of a deck, dice rolling, sort of this gothic tattoo iconography, skulls and flames and you know, all of this stuff that shows up in the artwork related to the Grateful Dead culture and that scene. That's where my head was at. It was a very simple parsing of the experience that there was no deeper meaning in it other than the experience itself. And what happened in the experience itself was up to chance. You know, it was a roll of the dice. The phrase comes to mind, the Agents of Fortune, the Blue Oyster Cult album, which has a magician on the front of it holding a deck of cards. And when I look back at that album cover now, it was an album that I had as a child that I loved and I listened to over and over again. I can see where some of the ideas in my mind during those hallucinations may have come from symbols like that, that I had digested earlier in my life, that indicated that the world was sort of mysterious and random, and that when you take a psychedelic and you tap into that space, sort of a sense or a pattern unfolds out of the randomness. And I was very into the idea of synchronicity and, you know, random events that happened on the psychedelic that would sort of give you a message, send you a message, give you an insight into the way the world was working or the direction that your life should be taken. And I had lots of very deep philosophical discussions with friends about the meaning of synchronicity and what it was all about. And a friend of mine actually coined a term, simuljacency, which was a mathematical description of how powerful a synchronicity was. Simuljacency is a concatenation of two words, simultaneous and adjacent. So if an event happens, like if you think the word crab, and someone walks by you and says the word crab, then that is a simuljacent synchronicity. They happen simultaneously and they happen right next to each other. So that's a very powerful synchronicity. Now, if you think crab and then a half hour later someone says crab, because it's not simultaneous and it's not necessarily adjacent, the synchronicity is lessened because of the distance in time and space. But the closer the synchronicities get together in time and space, the more you enter this realm of simuljacency. Okay, so this is, you can see where, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, occult philosophy, Jungian philosophy, sort of psychology of randomness and coincidence, all going into my thought patterns at the time. And there is a lot of this kind of karmic conspiracy philosophy running through the Grateful Dead scene, where you have people who need a miracle, right? That's a big thing in the Grateful Dead community. People who follow the band, sometimes they don't have tickets to the show, so they stand outside the show with a sign that says "Need a Miracle," or they dance and sing and say, "Hey, I need a miracle," and the Grateful Dead, they have a song, "Need a Miracle," every day. But the whole concept of needing a miracle and asking the universe to provide a miracle for you and then having that miracle happen is, you know, kind of this very psychedelic karmic conspiracy, called the karmic conspiracy. And those are the ideas that were kind of shaping my thought before I ever heard of Terence McKenna or ayahuasca shamanism or any of the deeper philosophies that go along with psychedelic culture. And still to this day, jam band culture, party culture, rave culture, festival culture, to me, these are all very legitimate forms of psychedelic use. I mean, they're probably the most legitimate form of psychedelic use because there is no agenda. It's a process that's self-sustaining, self-organizing. It emerges naturally. There's no band leader that has to say, "Hey, we're inventing a party culture around psychedelics." It just happens spontaneously. And the paradigm of psychedelic party culture will endure. It will exist forever, for the rest of the future of humanity, regardless of the law, regardless of prohibition, or regardless of any other psychedelic philosophy, party culture will endure, which is why I view it as maybe the purest form of psychedelic experimentation, because it just is. It just is what it is, and it happens naturally, and it's a force of society. But in the wake of prohibition, party culture was thrown under the bus. Party culture was no longer legitimate. It was no longer a legitimate form of psychedelic expression. It became outlawed. And there was a lot of backlash against that decision in the psychedelic community. There were a lot of people who were very upset. And it wasn't just party culture. It was people in the research community, specifically people who were looking at psychedelics as a way to enhance psychological or psychiatric therapies. Because in one single stroke of legislation, the government, the Congress, had delegitimized the psychedelic experience. They delegitimized it. They said there is no medical use. It's dangerous, potentially highly addictive, although we know that's not necessarily the case. And they put it in Schedule 1, the most restrictive schedule of all illegal drugs, meaning that nobody could use it for anything anymore. And after that decision, after prohibition, there was movement to re-legitimize psychedelics. This was the backlash to the prohibition, which was a backlash to the experimentation. So you've got two forms of backlash going on. One, the prohibition, and one, the backlash against the prohibition. And the backlash against the prohibition took the form of legal arguments, because prohibition itself is a legal tool. It's a legal judgment, and it's classifying psychedelics with a legal framework. So the only way to fight back against that legal classification was to look for loopholes in the legal law, in the process, in the law itself. The first loophole in the scheduling was that Schedule 1 substances theoretically have no legitimate medicinal value. That was the first tact to legitimize psychedelics, is to say, okay, well, if we can prove that psychedelics have a legitimate medicinal use, we can remove this restrictive scheduling and maybe get back to doing the research with these substances. So the first tack to re-legitimize psychedelics is the medicinal track. And that's moving on. You know, that's making a lot of progress. It's been, of course, 30 years, maybe 40 years, since everything went down and drugs were made illegal. But the medicinal community has kept going, with groups like MAPS and the Hepta organization continuing to do research, baseline research, dose response studies, clinical trials, preclinical trials, a lot of paperwork, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of money, a lot of people waiting, a lot of time spent trying to re-legitimize psychedelics, at least for just the smallest possible uses, like treating PTSD with MDMA, or treating cluster headaches with LSD or LSA or similar compounds. Limited applications. But then there's a flip side to that medicinal argument, which is when people say that psychedelics are a miracle cure, and that they can treat depression and anxiety and, you know, everything to AIDS and cancer. You talk to people, especially in the 90s, about ayahuasca and shamanism, it seemed like there was nothing that ayahuasca couldn't cure. Any intractable disease that Western medicine was having trouble struggling with, there was somebody in the community ready to step up and say, oh, I think ayahuasca can fix that. So there was this notion that in addition to psychedelics having a modest application in therapy for a few specific treatments, there were people who were saying that, you know, these are miracle drugs. These are miracle cures. And that's just not the case. They're not miracle cures. They can't be applied to treat cancer or AIDS or autoimmune disease. Maybe in the future they might be an adjunct to some form of therapy for stimulating the immune system. I don't know. Potentially they could have a very large impact. Psychedelics could have a very large impact in treating chronic disease if we find the right protocol and the right methods to do that. But I don't think in 1993 or 1994, or whenever I was getting involved in the psychedelic scene, that there had been any protocols invented for using psychedelics in any kind of therapy. So to me, the medicinal tract of re-legitimizing psychedelics had stalled. It was slow. It didn't seem like it was ever going to go anywhere. And again, on the other side, there were these people floating these hyperbolic suggestions that ayahuasca was a miracle cure. And I was willing to, for the time being, accept the possibility that it could be employed. Ayahuasca could be employed in treating cancer or treating autoimmune diseases or other intractable diseases. And I met a lot of other people who were of that same mind and were ready to go into medicine and were ready to go into oncology and get their medical degree so that one day they could employ ayahuasca or another psychedelic in the treatment of cancer or chronic illness. That day may come. If you have a chronic illness, you can go to the Amazon and have a shaman treat you with ayahuasca. The problem with that is that there are no efficacy studies about whether or not ayahuasca shamanism is effective in treating disease. It's one of the things that I would really like to see is some efficacy studies about ayahuasca shamanism and its effectiveness in treating certain diseases. Now, shamans don't belong to a professional group. They don't have to file reports about their patients. They don't have to answer to insurance companies or medical groups or medical boards where they get licensed and relicensed. So it's hard to track those statistics. And it seems to me that a lot of the talk about ayahuasca being a miracle cure is maybe hyperbole. Ayahuasca may be good at treating some things, but I don't know. I don't know for sure because I haven't seen the statistics and the results from any studies that say that that's so. The problem with that is you have people continuing to live with the belief that ayahuasca and psychedelics are miracle cures. Now, that doesn't mean that you can just eat as much psychedelics as you want and you're healing yourself because you're taking medicine. Of course, anybody who's studied psychedelics and drugs knows the old adage from Paracelsus that the only difference between a poison and a medicine is dosage. So even if you have a powerful medicine that's good for treating a few ailments, even if you take a little bit too much of that medicine, it can turn into a poison. So the healing paradigm and the medical paradigm, it does have its problem maybe hyperbolizing the use of psychedelics in the treatment of disease in the service of legitimizing the entire psychedelic experience. But it does come with a built-in warning saying if you take too much, then you've crossed the line from medicine into poison. And, of course, all psychedelic therapy relies on finding the correct dose range for treating the ailment that you're targeting. So that was the medicinal tract. The second tract, which is more problematic, is the religious freedom tract, which relates to the First Amendment of the Constitution, where the government cannot interfere in the practice of somebody's religion. So in order to legitimize the psychedelic experience, another group of people came together and said, we are going to make the case that taking psychedelics is a religious ritual. And therefore, in the context of the religious ritual, we are not breaking the law. We are practicing our First Amendment rights of freedom to religion. And that didn't just come out of nowhere. There is context for that. Psychedelics are used in religious ceremony, of course, in South America and Central America and North America, peyote ceremonies. There are, many examples of psychedelics being used in religious ceremony, at least among native cultures. So in the service of trying to legitimize psychedelics from a religious use standpoint, there was a little bit of cultural appropriation going on, where academics were appropriating the religious ceremonies of native groups and saying, well, if these are true religious ceremonies, then we need to create an exemption for this type of use. And there was actually a Supreme Court judgment that said, yes, Native American churches that use peyote in their religious ceremonies should be allowed to continue to use peyote in the religious ceremonies. So there was actually a victory in this track. The psychedelic use of peyote was legitimized for the specific purpose of having a Native American religious ceremony. But that opens up another problem, and that is the rebranding of psychedelics not as a drug or a medicine, but as a sacrament or an entheogen. The term entheogen was coined to rebrand the psychedelic experience as a legitimate religious experience. Entheogen, of course, meaning awakening of the divine within, and recognizing the psychedelic drug or plant as a sacrament, as a religious tool used for gaining some sort of divine wisdom within a religious ceremony. Now, the problem with that is that there is no implicit warning in the word entheogen or the word sacrament, because a sacrament does not have the same boundaries or restrictions that a medicine does. It doesn't come with a built-in warning saying that if you take too much of this sacrament, you might have an adverse reaction. So instead, you get a kind of hyperbolic propaganda around the religious use of psychedelics, saying that, oh, this is an ancient thing. This is a pure thing. This is a sacred thing. This is something that we need, you enter into with a pure heart and you walk away with, being touched by God or being touched by the wisdom of the universe. And there is all of this flowery talk about gnosis and touching the divine and being connected to the universe and the interconnectedness of all things. And there, all of that literature exists out there. And the connection to Buddhism and the connection to Hinduism, the connection to Tibetan theology, all of these world religions and shamanism were kind of pulled into this bouillabaisse of the psychedelic religious argument as a means of attempting to legitimize the psychedelic experience. Now, the third track, which is a very interesting track, is the historical context track, which is an offshoot of the religious argument that says, hey, visionary plants have been used in society since ancient times, historic times. You have Soma, you have the Kikion of the Eleusis Mysteries, the Eleusian Mysteries in Greece. You have all of these different cultural examples of visionary substances, visionary plants, being used in ceremony from around the world. And some of those are legitimate observations, but the historical context argument starts to get blurry when people start seeing visionary ceremony or references to visionary ceremony in every piece of artwork that might contain a mushroom or plant that might be identified as a visionary plant. So the historical context argument gets into this all of this crypto-ethnography about how the visionary experience has been hidden. It's been repressed, it's been oppressed, and it's had to go underground. And the only surviving records that we have of this visionary experience happening around the world come through these cryptic references in art, or maybe some ancient writings where a reference to a visionary plant, or maybe a visionary experience, or maybe something that could be construed as a visionary experience. And people go and catalog all of these instances and write books and make very, very convincing arguments that the visionary experience has been part of human culture since day one. And then you get to McKenna, who says, well, no, maybe psychedelics are actually an evolutionary link between proto-hominids and humans. And the use of the mushroom actually made our language evolve and made our thought evolve and made our art evolve and, you know, turned us from unthinking apes into the sapiens, the thinking apes that we are today. And that was the thesis of Food of the Gods. And I come back to this now because I have seen Terence say in lectures, when introducing the concepts in Food of the Gods, that he was essentially saying, well, Food of the Gods was my best, most academic attempt to try and re-legitimize the psychedelic experience in popular culture. That was his stated goal and intention, to re-legitimize the psychedelic experience by putting it in a historical context, in a prehistoric context. And I fully understand that, because there is this trend, this undercurrent of people in the community desperately wanting to re-legitimize the experience in the face of prohibition, because they see prohibition of this experience as not only an injustice, but as a sweeping away of one of perhaps the most interesting phenomenological events that a human being can have, which is the psychedelic experience, or the hallucinatory experience, or the visionary experience. And I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that despite the best intentions of all of these various different groups working, doing the research, writing the religious arguments, writing the legal arguments, writing the medicinal arguments, writing the historical context arguments, there was a tendency to hyperbolize and overstate the use or value of psychedelics, and concurrently understate the dangers. If you're trying to re-legitimize the substance, you don't want to come back and keep dwelling on the fact that the substance is also maybe dangerous, and the experience is also very dangerous, and that people need to be very careful when they work with these substances, because not only are they medicinal, not only are they religious, not only are they part of the historical context of human evolution, but they also might make you go crazy. So no one adds that last point when they're trying to make the re-legitimization argument. That last point gets left out of the discussion 99% of the time, I would say. And yes, over the years, as a publisher and a writer, I have been a cheerleader and a cautious advocate for the psychedelic experience. And very rarely, almost never, do I go into the negative aspects or dwell on the dangerous aspects. Because as I said, those aren't the ones that we want to be talking about. And I published magazines for 10 years, 15 years, and I published a blog for 5 years, and I published a book. And never once did I set aside a chapter or an article or a series of articles discussing the dangers of psychedelics and my personal experiences that crossed over the line from cautious experimentation to dangerous or reckless experimentation. And I feel like that's an omission, and I regret that omission. And it's maybe because of that regret that I decided to put together these 10 episodes to talk about these issues in some detail, and not just include a single chapter or a single episode or a few minutes talking about the negative effects or the potentially dangerous effects, but to put together a good 10 hours, 15 hours, maybe 20 hours by the end of it, discussing all of the issues that I feel have been left out of the discussion in my career with psychedelics, because I was so focused on looking at the good things and working with the re-legitimization arguments. And in the service of making the re-legitimization argument, or the legitimization argument, party culture and recreational use of psychedelics get thrown under the bus. You have to say, oh yes, psychedelics they're a sacrament. They're a medicine. They're part of the historical context. But, you know, dropping acid and watching movies or going out to a rave or a party, that's frowned on. That's a no-no because the government said that that's illegal. And I think that that's maybe a disservice to party culture, because party culture has its own mechanisms built in for controlling responsible usage. There's harm reduction, there's community efforts, there are people in the community working to make sure that people are educated and they have the right information that they need to take the right dose and get a pure substance and have a good time. And I think a lot of times that's not viewed as a legitimate cultural use. And I think that that's a disservice to party culture. I think that they need to be recognized for the work that they're doing, because when you step back and think about all the people, not only in the United States, but around the world, who are going to parties, going to festivals, going to shows, going to concerts, taking acid, taking mushrooms, taking ecstasy, taking whatever, the sheer numbers of people are in the hundreds of thousands, potentially millions every year, taking these substances. And realistically, a relatively small percentage, a very, very small percentage of the people in this entire party culture ever have a bad time. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Of course it happens. People overdose, people die, people have psychotic reactions. But there are also safeguards in the party culture that try to limit those freakouts. They have people ready to come in and treat people who are having a bad time and talk people down. And like I said, distributing educational materials and purity testing kits to make sure that people are getting the right substances in the right dose. And that's one of these aspects of psychedelic culture that I found most interesting, is that when left to its own devices in the face of prohibition and a black market where the purity of substances is sometimes unknown, the party culture came up with its own mechanisms for regulating safe use. It didn't need an organization, a top-down organization, telling it what to do. It didn't need a religious manifesto or some kind of ceremonial ritual guiding the practice. It was a peer-to-peer, ground-up, completely grassroots movement in the harm reduction community to put together the materials needed to make party culture safe, or as safe as possible. Now, of course, there's more that can be done, But I was always very impressed with how party culture managed to deal with the issues of safety within its ranks. And like I said, if you look at the numbers of people worldwide who take these substances recreational every year, the number of emergency room visits and overdoses are extremely small. And I just want to let everyone know that I know that up front. Overall, these substances, when used properly in the proper dosage, are safe. And usually the main thing that happens when people take a psychedelic substance is that they have a good time, or they enjoy themselves, or they have a weird time, or a wild time, or a freaky time. But it's not usually a dangerous time, or a horrifying time, or a terrifying time, although that does happen. But as an example of how these different tracks trying to legitimize psychedelic use work and view each other, I was at a small talk given by Rick Strassman at a house here in Seattle, and there were maybe 15 or 20 people gathered to listen to him. It was just kind of a small, informal salon kind of thing, and I, at the time, was publishing Trip magazine, which focused on all sorts of aspects of psychedelic culture, from the religious to the medicinal to the recreational, and even sort of the weird kind of surreal out there aspects, which is, you know, what we were always trying to focus on. We were trying to be a sort of a surreal community publication, the best that we could, and, you know, cover as much news that we could. And there was a woman at this talk who wanted to go into doing research with ayahuasca, medicinal research with ayahuasca. And I was interested in doing an interview with her and maybe talking about the different kinds of work that she was going into and the different kind of research she was doing. And she said, "Well, I'm not really sure about your publication because it's called Trip." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she says, "Well, Trip sort of has, you know, a recreational connotation. And I don't know if I want to be associated with that because it might seem kind of irresponsible." And I was very polite and I said, "Oh yeah, okay, I understand what you mean." But in my head, I was thinking, well, where did you first get exposed to psychedelics? Where does anybody in the US first get exposed to psychedelics? Is it in the medicinal scene? Is it in the religious scene? Is it part of some historical context? No. Most of the time, I would say almost all of the time, young people are exposed to psychedelics in party culture, in recreational culture, because that is the dominant culture. For better or for worse, that is the dominant culture in the psychedelic movement. You know, when you have things like Burning Man, you have these big festivals devoted entirely to the experience that are the dominant part of the culture. And like I said, I see this part of the culture as extremely legitimate, and there's no reason to deride it or look at it as irresponsible, because there are many responsible people in that community looking out for that community. In contrast, the people in the medicinal community and the religious community who wanted to promote their ideals of re-legitimizing the psychedelic experience within a legal framework and a legal context, they downplay or view the party culture as counter to their cause, because that's irresponsible usage. That's use that happens in a realm that's not regulated, that's not controlled, and beyond that, does not have any legal loophole within the United States Constitution. There is no loophole that says you have the right to party and have a good time. So the climate of prohibition and the dynamic created between prohibition and this backlash of re-legitimization allowed a lot of this hyperbolic rhetoric about entheogens and mysticism and gnosis and miracle cures and healing properties to trickle into the community. And these ideas became manifest. They became an encoded part of the culture, where not only were psychedelics a great party drug, a great recreational drug, or a great drug for personal psychic exploration, they were also religious sacraments and miracle cures. Because the people who are working to re-legitimize the experience say they are. Now, that may be disinformation. That may be a misreading of what people in the community are trying to say, or the ideas that people in the community are trying to put forward. But as somebody who is in the community and has been in the community and has talked with lots of people in the community, these ideas are out there. These ideas are out there that psychedelics are a miracle cure, that ayahuasca is a miracle cure, or that they are a legitimate sacrament and they do put you in touch with the mind of God or the mind of spirits. And I think that in some ways those ideas are dangerous. They're more dangerous than the ideas that psychedelics are just for a good time or just for personal exploration, because that at least sets a boundary on the realistic use of the substance. So I'm going to use this substance to have a good time, or I'm going to use this substance to explore my thoughts and get into my own head a little bit more. And now, instead of those dynamics, you have the dynamics of, well, I'm going to use psychedelics to see God, or I'm going to use psychedelics to heal myself of something. And those dynamics, I think, are much more dangerous, because if you don't heal something with one dose, you may try a bigger dose to heal it next time. Or if you want to hear voices and see spirits, but you don't hear voices or see spirits on a low dose, why not try a higher dose and see if that works? So the expectation of miracle healing and religious wisdom, I see now in retrospect as dangerous ideas, because they lead people down the path that psychedelics can't hurt me. If they're medicines and they're religious sacraments, they should only be looking out for my best interest. There is nothing dangerous here. And I've actually heard people say that to me when I've been at events or at Burning Man or at festivals, and I see people, you know, preparing their sacrament for the evening. I've said to people, you know, be careful. You know, smaller doses are probably better than large doses for recreational experiences, because you have a better time and there's a less chance you're going to freak out. I've always kind of been cautious towards lower doses as opposed to higher doses, because I know that the main factor between a good time and a psychotic episode is the dose range that you take. So I have said to people at parties, you know, be careful with your dose. You don't want to take too much. You just want to take enough to have a good time. And I've had people turn to me and say, well, what are you worried about? They're just psychedelics. As if to say, well, I'm not taking heroin. I'm not going to kill myself. They're just psychedelics. What harm can they do? And I'm here to say that they can do harm. Most of the time, with the proper dose, they're perfectly fine, and they don't have any lasting impact. But if you do just a little bit more than you're supposed to, or you're in the wrong situation when you're peaking, they can do a lot of harm. And I know from personal experience. when discussing the dangers of psychedelic drugs, they are admittedly very different than other types of drugs. We're not talking about fatal overdose or addiction. Most people know that psychedelics have a very low risk for those things. But what we are talking about is mental health and the effect of psychedelics on mental health. And mental health is a really tricky subject to talk about because there is a lot of shame and embarrassment and fear associated with talking about mental health. And by and large, people in the psychedelic community don't like to admit that lingering mental health issues may be a problem with psychedelic use. In fact, it's almost never discussed. I've been to many conferences organized over the years, and I don't think I've ever heard it discussed once. Not on stage, not among people I was chatting with, not anywhere. And yet, over the years, I've met people who've been adversely affected by psychedelic drugs. And I have known people who've had extremely bad experiences that they've never really recovered from. And occasionally, from time to time, a few times a year, I will receive an email from somebody who is asking questions about an experience they had, or wants to tell me about an insight that was revealed in an experience that they had. And after doing a little probing upon further inspection, I realize that this is a person who maybe has had a psychotic episode. A psychedelic reaction so bad that it left them rattled and confused and unable to figure out what exactly is going on with reality or their own head. And although the psychedelic community has organizations for promoting the therapeutic use of psychedelics and organizations promoting the religious and spiritual use of psychedelics, and organizations promoting harm reduction and the safe use of psychedelics, there really is no place supporting people who have found themselves lost or mentally damaged due to use of psychedelics. And I know this because when people write to me and reach out to me for help and advice, there is no place to send them. There is no expert or institute who can lead them through whatever it is that they're going through. They're on their own with their own health insurance or HMO, trying to find a doctor or a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist who can understand what they're going through. And oftentimes they're afraid to admit that maybe they are having some mental health problems because of a psychedelic trip. And maybe they're afraid to admit that they actually use psychedelics to a therapist or a counselor because of the paranoid fear of prohibition. Nobody wants to be put in jail. Nobody wants to be put in a mental institution. Nobody wants to be chided or scolded for accidentally messing their heads up with psychedelic experimentation. People, when they get in this situation, are not supported by the community. They are considered anomalies, or, more often, they just keep it to themselves, out of fear, out of shame, out of embarrassment. And maybe they try to shrug it off. But the problem with a psychotic episode, any kind of psychotic episode, whether it's naturally occurring, drug-induced, or what have you, is that if you have any high adrenaline event where you're in a panic state for more than a minute or two, there is a very real chance that you might cause a traumatic scar on your psyche. Those traumatic scars are often referred to as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. And PTSD has been documented in a wide variety of traumatic events, from combat to natural disasters to accidents, and even, you know, naturally occurring panic attacks can cause a post-traumatic stress disorder. And with psychotic episodes that happen in a psychedelic experience, the fallout can come in many forms. There can be a residual mania, a depression, paranoia, anxiety, confusion, a sense of loss or a sense of detachment from reality that could linger for weeks after a bad experience. And often when I get emails from people who have had a bad experience that they're trying to sort through, I can tell that even though the trip is over and the drugs have worn off long ago, they're still in it somehow. There's still a part of them that's in the experience that they can't let go of or they can't get out of. And they're reaching out to people to try and find a way to get out of whatever it was that they've gotten into, or conversely, bring other people into their delusional state to help confirm for them that they're not going crazy, or that they're not crazy, even though they might suspect that they are. Aftershocks, reverberations, flashbacks from a bad trip, a bummer, a freakout. The community has all sorts of different words for a psychotic episode. But the aftershocks can last a lifetime. Personal memory is imprinted by a release of adrenaline, and high adrenaline events will imprint extremely detailed memories which will last a lifetime. So regardless of how you find yourself in a high adrenaline event or a psychotic episode, those memories will stick with you and will create a lasting impact on your life. Now, sometimes it's easy to come out of a psychotic episode and say, "I'm glad that's over," or "What was that all about?" and continue on with your life. But other times it's difficult to integrate and you need help. And there are very few people out there who are experts and who are ready and willing to help people in this situation. And I think that that's a problem. And that's not just a problem of the psychedelic community. To be fair, I've met people from all walks of life who have never tried psychedelics or any other drugs, who have mental conditions that they're having trouble treating because of these issues of shame, embarrassment, fear of admitting to yourself that you need help. And in the last episode, the first episode that I recorded of this 10-episode series, I started into a narrative about the summer of 1993 and how that was a very busy summer for me, which culminated in me driving to Occidental, California to meet and interview Kat Harrison and Terrence McKenna. But I also said that during that summer, I got the idea to forge a backstage pass to Lollapalooza, and I met Timothy Leary, and I had traveled to conferences, and I saw the Grateful Dead a couple times. And as I was piecing together the events of that summer, after I finished recording the episode, I realized that in the middle of that summer, I had the first psychotic episode on mushrooms that I've had in my life. And at the time, I didn't think it really affected me that much. Like I said, sometimes you can just shrug it off and carry on with your life. And I really felt like I had that experience, and then I got over it, and then I continued on with my life. But when I was going back and piecing together the events of that summer, I realized that the letter writing that I was doing to all the people in the community happened essentially the week after that trip. And me forging the backstage pass to Lollapalooza happened maybe a week and a half after that trip. And me getting in touch with Terrence McKenna and agreeing to go interview him happened within 3 weeks of that trip. And there are some unusual things that I remember about that time that will shed some light on my headspace. I remember writing these letters to people in the psychedelic community, and before I would put them in the mail, I would hold my hand over the letters and imagine them being bathed in white light, like a spell that I was putting on the letters, in the hopes that when they arrived, that the person who got this letter would realize that it was important and would contact me. And I remember when I saw the picture of Les Claypool from Primus in the Entertainment Weekly holding up his backstage pass, I felt somewhere in my mind that he was holding it up for me. Not specifically for me, but maybe with the intent that somebody out there would see it and get the idea to come backstage and say what's up or give him a high five. So I was probably a bit manic at that point in my life. I had had a psychotic break on mushrooms a week earlier, and I was in this residual headspace where I was living in a magical reality, maybe even a delusional reality, where I felt that the universe was pushing me in a direction or leading me with clues towards a pathway of discovery. And as I was piecing this timeline of events together, I began to realize that maybe that psychotic break I had on mushrooms did not just dissipate when the drugs wore off. Maybe there was a residual effect that kicked me into action, that made me start reaching out to people in the community to figure out what was going on and what had happened to me. And the strange thing that I'm coming to realize is that back in 1993, that rattled kid trying to recover from a bad trip, reaching out and looking for answers, that was me. I was that kid. And the melodrama thickens. Like I said when I started this, I've had some things planned that I wanted to talk about, and some big ideas and lingering thoughts about my career in the psychedelic culture. And to be honest, up until this point, I've never really sat down and had a chance to reflect on all the things that have happened to me since I got involved in exploring psychedelics. And beyond that, got involved in the community looking for answers. And one of the things that I said was that maybe as I start into this, I may start remembering things that I had forgotten. I may remember stories from the past that I don't dwell on anymore. And this could be one of them. The fact that my whole approach to the psychedelic community, my reaching out, my looking for answers, my quest to find somebody at the top of the hierarchical chain in the community who knew what was going on, began the week after I had had the most powerful psychedelic trip in my life. Now, I never put those two things together until just now, as I was planning to record this section. And it gives me a lot of insight into what motivated me to start looking for answers in the first place. Because there was this thing that happened when I was in the psychedelic space that I could not explain and I could not figure out. And there was nothing in any of the books or manuals that I was reading that could even come close to touching this experience. So I wanted to find people in the community who I could talk to about this thing and figure out what it is. Because I was very frustrated at the time that all of the books that I was reading and all of the articles that I was reading and all of the interviews that I was reading and all the materials that I could find, which were not a lot of materials. Again, this was before the internet. And I would, you know, spend a Saturday afternoon driving an hour to the closest library where I could find a book by John Lilly, for instance, just to see what other people had to say about this. And what frustrated me was that a very small portion of the literature out there on psychedelics was actually about what happens in the psychedelic experience. There's all of this adjunctive stuff about philosophy and theory and culture and ethnobotany and anthropology and botany and chemistry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing in the middle of the experience, the thing that I was trying to figure out, was elusive. Nobody was talking about that thing. And that's the only thing that I was interested in. I wanted to get to the meat. I wanted to get to the middle. I wanted to understand what was going on there in the peak, the synchronicity hole. That's what I called it. So this process of me reaching out and trying to find people in the culture and eventually getting involved in publishing all stems from maybe that one episode that left me rattled and confused and looking for answers. And that's a very interesting idea, because since I've been in the community and since I've started publishing and worked with a wide variety of people and attracted a lot of people to the projects that I was working on, I discovered that many of the people that I have worked with in their past had one big, huge psychedelic freakout that changed the course of their life in one way or another, led them to seek out others, led them to change the path of their career or schooling, led them to move, led them to change their passions in life. And it's not the little psychedelic trips. It's not the fun psychedelic trips. It's not the goofy psychedelic trips that cause people to kick into action like that. It is the big ones. It is the big ones that leave you reeling and spun around and directionless and looking at the sky that make you alter the course of your life in ways that you didn't foresee before. And if that's the only thing that I get out of the process of putting together these 10 episodes, that's enough for me. That's right there a little bit of wisdom that maybe I had considered in the past but never really saw with my eyes open, how much the bad trips can change your life and alter you in a way that you didn't foresee. Maybe a positive way, maybe a negative way. It's hard to say because you don't know what you would have been like without that trip. And there is a sentiment in the psychedelic community that goes, well, sometimes the bad trips are more rewarding than the good trips because you learn way more. And I've never really bought into that because, to me, bad trips are bad trips. You want to avoid them. You don't want to gloss over them or understate their impact on your life by saying, well, maybe it's a good thing you had a bad trip. No, I don't think it's ever a good thing that you've had a bad trip. Like I said, because they could have a lasting impact on your psyche. It can cause symptoms like post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, paranoia, bipolar, depression, mania, that last and recur for your entire life. So I don't want to get slipping into the weird mantras and dogma of the psychedelic community that say, hey, bad trips are, you know, just as good for you as good trips. No, I don't buy that. I also don't buy the thread that says, oh, if you had a bad trip or a bummer and you come out on the other side feeling lost and confused, well, what you have to do is take more and go back in and sort it out. No, I absolutely reject that as well. There is no proper protocol in the psychedelic community for what to do after you have a bad trip. The literature is not there. There is no support group. There is no expert. There is no place to go where you can sort out what happened to you. And I think that that is a real, large, glaring hole in what we consider to be a relatively well-rounded culture. And my only advice for people who come to me after they've had a bad trip or a psychotic episode and they're looking for answers, that may be you, that may be somebody you know, my only advice is to find a therapist and start talking about it immediately. And I'm not talking about a psychiatrist that's going to treat you with drugs or going to treat your symptoms with drugs. I mean, find a talk therapist. And it doesn't have to be somebody who's familiar with psychedelic drugs. Just somebody who's familiar with anxiety and PTSD and the issues related to high adrenaline events and the impact that they have on memory and mood. Because I think that would be more helpful than all of the psychedelic philosophy that you could consume combined. Just having someone that you could go to talk about it and figure out how you got spun around and figure out how to undo it. And that's, you know, it may seem like an obvious thing to say. Oh yeah, if you feel like you've become mentally unstable after a psychedelic trip, then go see a therapist. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying any bad trip that you have, even if you feel like after the drugs have worn off and you've shrugged it off, any big negative psychedelic experience that you might have that left you feeling scared and confused or panicked for more than a few minutes, you need to go get that treated. you need to go get that treated, because that's not just going to evaporate from your mind, and it's not just going to evaporate from your life. That's going to stick with you. And there are no rules or guidelines in the psychedelic community for how to deal with that event sticking with you and hanging with you your entire life. You need to find a therapist who's going to give you support, sympathy, coping strategies, and more than anything else, someone to talk to, somewhere where you can voice these things, these lingering thoughts that may sound crazy, that may sound psychotic, where you can go and voice these things without fear, without the fear of being judged, or without the fear of being institutionalized. Because I think that's a big problem that people in the wake of these trips have, especially if they happen alone and there aren't many people around to talk to about what happened that you can trust. You can't just hold on to these and keep them to yourself. You need to go out and get help. You need to find someone who will listen and be sympathetic and understand and help you work through that. And the sooner that you can get into therapy to start working through the psychological impact of a bad trip, I think the quicker you can recover from it and get your mental health back under you before you slide out into a manic phase or a high anxiety phase, a paranoid phase, however that psychic trauma manifests in the wake of the event. And I'm just saying this because if there was somebody in the community back in 1993 who just told me that, who was just able to say, hey kid, you had a psychotic episode, go find somebody to talk about it with, digest it, work through it, go get some help. I didn't get that from anybody. And of course, at the time, I didn't even realize I had had a psychotic episode. Like, we didn't call it that. We called it freaking out or having a bummer or having a bad trip. But in retrospect, now that I know more about the mind and mental illness, I know for sure that's what I had. I know for sure it was a psychotic episode. And if I had had the tools and the direction to deal with it, maybe my life would be very different today. Who knows? Message to you, Rudy. Sometimes when I'm recording here, I get a song stuck in my head. That's The Specials from another one of my favorite albums of all time, The Specials, their debut album. A Message to You, Rudy, which I always loved. A rock and roll song that's also a message to get your life together, to clean up your act. And I'm not addressing that to anyone in particular, other than myself. Because this is a serious topic, and one that I'm going to continue exploring for the next 8 episodes as we wind down Dose Nation. In this episode 2 of 10, The Unraveling.